Well, we were visiting Michael and Carissa, our son-in-law and daughter, last summer back in Mississippi. One day, Lori and I decided we would go for a walk because it had been very hot, but it had cooled down to a balmy 2,000 degrees, you know. So we went for this walk, which proved to be shorter than we had anticipated because we were melting in the humidity. But on our way home, we approached this house where there were a couple of dogs sitting out in the front. They were not on leashes. They were just roaming freely. And one of them was a German Shepherd who started barking at us as soon as we got in the same time zone as he and his property. Now, Lori has something of a thing about German Shepherds. You know, some of you probably love German Shepherds. Lori has an issue with German Shepherds, probably dating back to an incident she had a number of years ago when she was walking our dog, the late Luke, and was attacked by two German Shepherds. You know, she's mistrustful of these dogs. And so as we're walking, I'm looking at this dog, and he's just getting more and more aggressive as we're getting in close to their house. And you could almost see him going, "Oh, great, lunch is arriving," you know. And so we just went, okay, we're steering clear of this guy. And we walked, we crossed the street. And as we're getting opposite their property, we actually walked through the front yard of the house across the street to get as far from him as we could. And he barked at us the whole way. And we kind of kept one eye on him and one eye out for, okay, if he attacks, where are we going to go? You know, we made it by, although he, you know, Cujo, man, he was just snarling and barking at us the whole way. I remembered that as I studied the passage that we're going to look at today as we continue our study of the life of David. Because it occurs to me that there have been a few people in my life that remind me of that mutt. You know, people that you just, you know, you kind of, they bark and they snarl and you got to be on guard around them because you never can tell what they're going to do next. Have you ever had somebody like that in your life? You know, just maybe one of those people just knows how to push your buttons. You're kind of on guard around them all the time. I recall it. There was a guy, it's interesting, when I was in college, there's a guy that moved into the dorm where I was living. It was just a few doors down from me. And this guy was a guy that if you had a conversation with him that lasted more than a couple of sentences, you would end up in an argument with him. He just was prickly, arrogant, and argumentative, and you just couldn't talk to him without coming away just grinding your teeth. It was kind of like that mutt. We had a neighbor. We've had actually several. One of them, I remember the day he moved in, we welcomed him. Lori actually baked some cookies, and we went over and we welcomed him to the neighborhood. And that day was the last pleasant interaction I had with that guy. Every other one, I came away from going, "Oh, what a mutt," you know. So today, we're going to look at an incident where David encounters a mutt in his life. And we're going to see what we can learn from David's interaction with this guy. It's in 2 Samuel chapter 16. When David had gone a short distance beyond the summit, David and his people are leaving Jerusalem when this happens. There was Ziba, the steward of Mephibosheth, waiting to meet him. He had a string of donkeys saddled and loaded with 200 loaves of bread, 100 cakes of raisins, 100 cakes of figs, and a skin of wine. The king asked Ziba, "Why have you brought these?" Ziba answered, "The donkeys are the king's household to ride on. The bread and fruit are for the men to eat, and the wine is to refresh those who became exhausted in the wilderness." The king asked him, "Where is your master's grandson?" Ziba said to him, "He's staying in Jerusalem because he thinks today the Israelites will restore me, my father's kingdom." Then the king said to Ziba, "All that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours." "I humbly bow," Ziba said, "may I find favor in your eyes, my lord the king." As King David approached Bahurim, a man from the same clan as Saul's family came out from there. His name was Shimei, son of Gera, and he cursed as he came out. He pelted David and all the king's officials with stones, though all the troops in the special guard were on David's right and left. As he cursed, Shimei said, get out, you murderer, you scoundrel. The Lord has repaid you for all the blood you shed in the household of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. The Lord has given the kingdom into the hands of your son Absalom. you've come to ruin because you are a murderer. Then Abishai, son of Zeruiah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and cut off his head. But the king said, what does this have to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? If he is cursing because the Lord said to him, curse David, who can ask, why do you do this? David then said to Abishai and all his officials, my son, my own flesh and blood is trying to kill me. How much more than this Benjamite? Leave him alone. Let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look upon my misery and restore me to his covenant blessing instead of this curse today. So David and his men continued along the road while Shimei was going along the hillside opposite him, cursing as he went, throwing stones at him and showering him with dirt. The king and all the people with him arrived at their destination exhausted, and there he refreshed himself. Well, okay, David is at a low point in his life. Betrayal, it's one of the worst things that can happen to you, a person. I can tell you from personal experience, being stabbed in the back by someone who's supposedly an ally is exceedingly painful, but even disoriented, cause you to question your own judgment, feel like you can't trust anybody. Well, David experienced the worst of that because he's been betrayed by his own son. David's son Absalom, we saw last week, led a rebellion against his father. Absalom had been plotting against his father for years. And this now, the rebellion has broken out into the open. And this was a cold-blooded, eyes-wide-open, intentional effort to do serious harm to his own father. Fact is, Absalom and everyone knew that for Absalom to take over the throne, which he aimed to do, David would have to die. So as this is happening, David thinks, it seems like that there's this groundswell of support for Absalom. David thought, you know, if he stays in Jerusalem, he's a dead man. Task number one for the rebels is going to be to kill the sitting king, which was David. And so David gathers his forces that are loyal to him and heads out of Jerusalem on the road toward Jericho. He's feeling sorrowful and sad, just his heart broken because his own son has betrayed him, but also he's feeling like even his people that he's tried to serve have turned on him. One of his most trusted advisors was a guy named Ahithophel. This guy was actually the smartest knife in the drawer. He was a really good advisor. He has gone over to Absalom's side. He's betrayed David along with Absalom. And right here in this instance, we see that David encounters Ziba, who's a former servant of Saul that David had dealt with before, who'd helped him find Mephibosheth, the only remaining descendant of Saul, of one of Jonathan's sons. We had seen earlier that everybody thought David tracked Mephibosheth down to try to kill him, but instead, David wanted to love on the guy, and he brought him into his court, and gave him a position of power, and cared for him, and gave him land, and just took care of him. Well, Ziba informs David that Mephibosheth has also turned on David and thinks, hey, this is great. David's leaving. Maybe we'll get to take the throne over again. So there are a lot of people turning on David. You know, you wonder, how does that happen? David was a great king. Sadly, we saw last week, it's a fairly predictable turn of events. You know, after someone's been in leadership for a while, you know, their flaws become more apparent. People focus more on them. They get criticized more and more. And pretty soon that's all people can see. And to make matters worse, no leader is perfect. Plus, they can never measure up to everyone's expectations of them and give people everything they want. And so there's an automatic sort of gap there. This happened even to some of the greatest leaders in history. George Washington was revered as a military leader during the American Revolution, but then he became president, and guess what happened? He began getting criticized. One newspaper of the day wrote to him that posterity would, quote, not fail to render the just sentence of condemnation on the man who has entailed upon his country deep and incurable public evils. That was about George Washington. Actually, in an early draft of George Washington's farewell speech, he wrote this, that the newspapers of his day teemed with all the invective that disappointment, ignorance of the facts, and malicious falsehoods could invent to misrepresent my politics and affections, to wound my reputation and feelings, and to weaken, if not entirely destroy, the confidence you have been pleased to repose in me. That was the great father of our country who felt like that. He actually ended up thinking that was maybe a little too bitter, so he cut it out of his farewell speech. Abraham Lincoln, same fate. One editorial from his home state said he was, quote, no more capable of becoming a statesman, even a moderate one, than a braying donkey can become a noble lion. His weak, wishy-washy, namby-pamby efforts, imbecile in manner, disgusting in manner, have made us the laughingstock of the whole world. Leading orator of the day, Edward Everett, said Lincoln was, quote, a person of very inferior cast of character, wholly unequal to the crisis. General George McClellan called him the original gorilla. And famous abolitionist Elizabeth Cady Stanton said when Lincoln was running for re-election, you might find this humorous, that if he was re-elected, quote, I shall immediately leave the country for the Fiji Islands. Does that sound familiar? My point is, leaders, this kind of stuff happens to them. And David is right in the teeth of it. It's one of the lowest days of his life. Wounded in soul, uncertain of his future, discouraged, hurting, fearful for his life and the life of his friends. And at that moment, a mutt shows up. This guy, Shimei, kicked David when he was down. As he and his troops near the village at the village of Bahurim, which is the home of this guy, Shimei, this guy shows up. He's of the clan of Saul, and he has never gotten over the fact that David has replaced Saul. He felt about David a little bit like I feel about Dean Spanos, owner of the Los Angeles Chargers, also known as Lucifer. David has been in power for years, but Shimei has never let go of his bitterness. Man, talk about holding on to a grudge. This guy is thrilled that David is being run out of Jerusalem. Now, you get a feel for the level of his resentment when you realize, look, if Absalom prevails, it's not going to do anything good for the clan of Saul and for Shimei himself. Absalom's just going to be another David's son who's going to rule. Not going to help the clan of Saul. But Shimei doesn't care about that. He just wants to see David hurt. That's all he cares about. Last week, the Union Tribune published an article, was written by a sports writer from St. Louis, who was expressing sympathy for San Diego football fans following the perfidious decision by Lucifer Spanos to move the Chargers. He could sympathize because last year the owner of the St. Louis Rams moved in from St. Louis to Los Angeles. And so he wrote about, in this article, the glee that he experienced watching the Rams lose this year. They had a bad year, and he was so happy about it. And he talked about how happy he was when he saw them on TV playing before thousands of empty seats in Los Angeles. And he talked about how his favorite National Football League team now is whatever team is playing against the Rams. And I thought, that's exactly how I feel. And here's the problem, you know, if the Chargers lose games, that won't benefit me any. It won't. There's nothing good that comes from that. I just want to see Lucifer hurt. But I just want to be clear, I'm not bitter. Yeah. This is what was going on with Shimei. It wasn't about some benefit coming from him. He just hated David, and he wanted to see David hurt. And he's thrilled with what's happening to David. So as David is walking, coming out along the road, this guy comes on the hillside next to the road and starts throwing rocks at David. And he's firing invective at him. He's dropping every possible combination of F-bomb from the Hebrew language that you could possibly imagine at him. And what's really awful is that he even claims that this is God's doing. He says in verse 8, the Lord has given the kingdom in the hands of your son Absalom. Was that true? No. He's saying, God is out to get you, David. God's finally getting you, giving you what you deserve. You're a murderer. You killed all these people from Saul's family. None of that was really true. But he's saying, God is now getting you back for the blood that's on your hands. Now, so David is being falsely accused by this guy. Here's David. He's at the lowest point of his life. What he needs is some encouragement. And this is what he's getting from this guy. But one of the things that really hurt, I think, for David is Shimei saying, you have come to ruin because you're a murderer. Here's the hard part. Shimei didn't know it, but David was a murderer. And David knew it, and he's hearing those words, and it's cutting him to the heart because he had been responsible for putting to death Uriah, an innocent man. Man, this is painful for David. But here's an amazing thing. David did not retaliate. You know, when you go through something like what David experienced that day, your heart cries out for vindication. You know, when someone's falsely accusing you or reveling in your downfall or claiming that God is condemning you, what do you want to have happen? You want nothing more than for that guy to get smacked in the face, for God to do something to him. You want him to get his. Years ago, I was listening to the radio one day as I was driving, and I heard an interview with the former Notre Dame football coach and ESPN TV analyst, Lou Holtz. Now, Lou Holtz is a guy whose life and character I really respect. I never had much respect for his football opinions, but that's another issue. But in this interview, he told a story of something that happened to him. He was coaching at the time at the University of Arkansas as a head coach, and he had a run of 5 very successful years, and then he had 1 mediocre year where his team basically, you know, won as many as they lost. And he was fired by the athletic director. Just out of the blue. You know, totally really seemed unfair. And he talked about how he could not believe the AD would do this to him. And he was totally blindsided. He thought it was unfair. And he talked about how he stewed and got boiling mad. And he began talking to his wife and telling her about the blistering things he was going to say about the AD the next day at his press conference as he had to respond to this. Talk about what a terrible decision this was, how poorly he's being treated, and how awful the AD was. He was ready to let go because he'd been hurt and he wanted to shoot back. Now, I'll tell you what happened in just a few minutes. In David's case, one of his most loyal men, Abishai, basically had that reaction. He said, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and cut off his head. Not only is this guy Shimei a mutt, he's a dead mutt. And one of the things we need to know is that, you know, dead dog was an ancient Hebrew way of, it was the classic idiom. It was one of the worst insults you could give to someone. It was basically, yeah, this guy's a piece of excrement is what he's saying. And he says, let me go over and cut off that mutt's head because he deserves it. David's response is amazing. Instead of anger and vindictiveness, there's just calm and peace. Maybe he felt Shimei was justified in cursing him because of the sin in his own life that he'd committed against Uriah. But whatever the case, he says, you know what? God has told him to curse. Let him curse. I'm putting this whole thing in God's hands. If God decides to bless me and to return me to blessing, then so be it. If not, and God has told this guy to curse, then let him curse. And that's all he does. In so doing, David was demonstrating some very new covenant behavior. In Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 and 39, Jesus said, you've heard that it was said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. You know, now that sometimes gets a little misunderstood. We need to understand that's primarily about an insult. It's not about protecting yourself if you're physically attacked. But understand, Jesus said, you've heard eye for eye. And frankly, that sounds about right to me. Doesn't it to you? You know, give people what they deserve. They're mean, be mean right back, you know. That seems fair, you know. If somebody tries to hurt you, well, let them have it right back, you know. That seems like a fair deal, you know. It's the punishment fits the crime kind of thing. But Jesus says, no, true righteousness just turns the cheek. It says, you want to insult me? Go right ahead. Take another shot. Take your best shot. And doesn't fight back. Now, to understand how far David went with this, we have to look a little further on in his life to 2 Samuel chapter 19. In that chapter, the civil war is over, and David has won. Absalom has lost. In fact, at this point, Absalom is dead. And David now, in chapter 19, is coming back to Jerusalem to resume the throne. And as he's about to cross the Jordan River, a bunch of people come out to welcome him back to his throne. And guess who's leading the pack? It's the mutt. It's Shimei. And he, in verses 19 and 20, he says this to David. May my Lord not hold me guilty. Do not remember how your servant did wrong on the day my Lord left, Lord the king left Jerusalem. May the king put it out of his mind. For I, your servant, know that I have sinned, but today I have come here as the first from the tribes of Joseph to come down and meet my Lord the king. How does that, does that sound sincere to you? That's terrible. Oh, you know what, David, remember that day I did that thing? Let's forget about that, because that was bad of me. My bad, I'm sorry. Can we just sort of move on now, you know? Man, oh man. This is nothing but a poorly disguised attempt for Shimei to save his crummy skin. Which of Shimei's comments do you think reflected his true feelings? Were they the comments that he made to David when David was escaping Jerusalem in chapter 16? He was calling him all these terrible names because he hated him. Or were they the words that he shares here in chapter 19 when he says, that was terrible of me. I shouldn't have said that. Which of those was probably his real heart? It was chapter 16, right? He reminds you of one of those public figures, an athlete or an on-air person who says something politically incorrect and a huge storm erupts, and then they come out the next day with an apology, and you know, it's like, yeah, the problem here, dude, is what you said is what you really think. You know, yeah, you're apologizing to it about it because you want the storm to stop. That's all. And that's what's going on with this guy. Abishai gets it. He wants to cut it off his head again, you know. You know what David does? Absolutely nothing. He just says to Shimei, don't worry about it. You're going to live. I'm going to take no action against you. Nothing. Now, the amazing thing about that is David wasn't fooled by his apology any more than you or I are. He knew exactly what Shimei really thought. And we know that because when David was just about to die and he's handing over the throne to Solomon, he warns Solomon about Shimei and says, you can't trust this guy. He knows he's still an enemy, and he warned Solomon about him. But he didn't take action against him, just turned the other cheek. Now, to understand how really remarkable that is, I want you to think about an incident that we looked at earlier in David's life. It happened back in 1 Samuel chapter 25. And that was an incident where David was leading his men, and they were providing security for some of the wealthy people in their area for their flocks and herds. This was in 1 Samuel 25. And he encounters this guy, Nabal, who after taking care of his flocks and herds, he sends some guys over to say, would you be willing to, you know, pay us for this, for all the service we've given you? And Nabal responded by basically insulting David, saying, who's David? I'm not going to give you a dime because you're just an outlaw. You're the problem, not the solution. Do you know how David responded to that insult? He said to his men, strap on your swords, 400 of you. Let's go see Nabal. Now, David got waylaid by Nabal's wife, Abigail, who realized disaster's about to happen. And she comes and she says, David, don't do this thing that you're about to do. And she saves him from it. But what's interesting is in verses 33 and 34 in that passage in chapter 25, David says this to Abigail, may you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands. Otherwise, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has kept me from harming you, if you had not come quickly to me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been left alive by daybreak. Nabal insults David, and David says, I'm not going to just get Nabal. I'm going to kill every man in his household. Man, that's retaliation, big time. Years later, Shimei, on maybe the worst day of David's life, insults him, and David just says, God tells him to curse, let him curse. Something has changed. Something changed in David. He's grown up. He's understanding how God wants him to relate to people. Now, maybe that happened because of Abigail. I think it's very possible it was her influence on him that caused that. Maybe it's because David himself has had his heart broken by his own sin and has been softened and realized, this is not how I should live. But whatever happens, he's completely different than he was back in 1 Samuel chapter 25. He responded as Jesus taught us that we are to respond with grace and forgiveness. Okay, what are the implications for us of this little incident? You know, nice, interesting historical incident, but so what? Well, this has to do with new covenant relating. There's more to significance to David's encounter than just an odd historical incident. I mean, you have to ask yourself, why did the writer of Samuel, really, why did God think it important for us to record this incident involving this guy Shimei, who really wasn't an important historical character? I mean, he's just this random guy that sort of shows up, and he's kind of a jerk. He's a mutt, and he shows up, and then he goes away. And like, why is this here? It's here because it's telling us something about how God wants us to relate to people, even mutts. What forms our way of relating is the way Jesus relates to us. Does Jesus respond in kind to the way we treat him? No, he never does. He continually pours out on us love and grace and forgiveness when we do not deserve it. And then he says, that's how I want you to relate to other people. Paul put it this way in Romans chapter 12, verse 17, do not repay anyone for evil. In verse 21, he wrote, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Now, evil is when someone hurts us or treats us unfairly or treats us unkindly or isn't, you know, loving towards us. And our natural tendency is to respond by giving back to them exactly what they give to us. The new covenant way is not to do that. Instead, Paul says, there's only one way to overcome another person's evil, and it's not being more evil. It's by being good back. Matthew 5:44, Jesus said, we should love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us. You know, it's funny, recently Lori was taking care of Ella, our little granddaughter, and Ella was not having her best day. She wasn't feeling really good, and she was fussy, and she was cranky, and she kind of wanted to be held all the time, you know, all day long, and she would kind of have little temper outbursts every now and then for no apparent reason. And at lunchtime, you know, Lori sat her in a little high chair, and she gave her, she had raspberries and cheese and some other things, and, you know, Ella ate a little bit of it, and then she just started going, and it was all on her little tray there, and it just made an unbelievable mess in the kitchen. I mean, there's cheese and raspberry, there's just stuff everywhere on the floor. And it was interesting to watch Lori relate to her. She didn't say, man, what is wrong with you? You're just so fussy and cranky, I've had enough of it, and now you're making a mess? Clean it up yourself. She was patient. She was kind, she was loving, and all of the little fussiness just made Lori go, I know you're not feeling well, and more tender towards her. Isn't it interesting that we can understand with a little one-year-old that what they need when they're just having a bad day is to be given more love and patience and kindness, but we forget that when they're an adult mutt, they might need the same thing. And instead, we give them back exactly what they give to us. As you know, the day Lori and I were to fly to Seattle to attend the funeral, go up for Lori's mother, on the way to the airport, I forgot my wallet. Again, you know. It was interesting when I told her this, when I told Lori this, she initially laughed. She thought I was trying to pull a prank on her, you know, make her. I said, not kidding, don't have it. She stopped laughing. She didn't say a lot, but it's amazing how much you can communicate without words, you know, nonverbal stuff. I felt this torrent of, I am unhappy with you. I'm upset with you. I am angry at you. How could you be so dumb coming at me? You know, and because I could see her going, what if we miss our flight? I'm going to miss my mother's funeral. How could you be so dumb? You know, and it was interesting. I noticed my response that I was feeling inside her. You know what I wanted to do back? Was to say, yeah, well, I'm feeling really bad here. I'm feeling really dumb, and I think what I need is a little bit of understanding, you know, and a really good wife would be supportive and, you know. Because when someone gets upset with you, you have a tendency to just mirror right back what they give you. That's natural human instinct, isn't it? And Jesus says, don't do that. Because I don't do that to you. What I want you to do is to do to others what I do to you, which is to give them grace and patience and kindness and love, even when they don't deserve it. Although Lori did deserve it. Let me be clear about that. So how are we going to do that? Well, this is going to require focusing on what life is really about. I submit to you that life for us as followers of Jesus Christ is really supposed to be about glorifying God and loving other people, right? Isn't that what Jesus said? Here's the most important thing. Love God, love people. That's what your life is about. That's what you're on the planet to do. That is the meaning of the whole thing. Our difficulty is we lose track of that, don't we? And we start thinking our lives are about protecting ourselves, making ourselves feel good, bringing honor to ourselves. Someone treats us an unkind way, we want to then lash back at them. They're attacking the thing that life is all about, which is me, right? But when we remember that our lives are about glorifying God and about loving people, loving God, loving people, doesn't that change the equation? Don't we say, wait a minute. I need to relate to this mutt in the way that Christ relates to me so that I can love this person and that I can glorify God. Last year I was watching a playoff hockey game. And it was a very intense game, really hard hitting, got a little chippy, you know, and there were a lot of penalties called. But it was interesting what happened late in the game. All of a sudden players started playing a lot cleaner. And then there was one incident in particular where one guy hit another with just a vicious cross check in the back. Cross check is where you take both hands on your stick and just go bam and hit somebody. Well, he hit this guy in the back and just knocked him down. And it was a blatant, you know, bad, cheap play. And when the victim, he just jumped up and he whirled around and you could see him, he was ready to shoot right back. But then he's just stopped. And he just dropped his hands and he didn't do a thing. You know what happened there? He kept his eyes on the big picture on what it was all about. He suddenly went, we're here to win this game. And it's a tie game and it's late in the game. If I hit back, that guy and I are both going to go to the penalty box. But if I don't do a thing, that guy is going to the penalty box and my team's going to have a power play and a chance to win the game. And he did nothing because he kept his eye on the point of the thing. It's about winning the game, not about getting even. And for us, that's going to be key. What is the point of this thing? It is about loving other people so that I can glorify God and express my love to him. And so when someone shoots at me, and I feel that welling up that I want to hit back, I go, ah, what's it about? Oh yeah, it's about loving this person. How can I do that? In fact, that is the only way that we can become what Jesus says we are to be, which is peacemakers. But here's a critical element of that. This ability to relate in this new covenant style of relating comes from confidence in God. The crucial words in this passage are in verses 12 and 13 as Shimei is firing rocks at him and swearing at him. On the worst day of his life, David said, leave him alone, let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be the Lord will look upon my misery and restore me as covenant blessing instead of his curse today. I'm putting it all in God's hands. It's up to God to decide what to do. He had confidence that God was there and God would take care of the situation. That confidence, I think, in David's life had come through years of difficulty, through having been hounded by Saul and when, by any reasonable analysis, David should have just killed Saul and he didn't. He just trusted and trusted and trusted and God took care of him. And now David is saying, I'm going to now do the same thing. I'm going to trust that God will take care of me. If someone is unfair, unkind, angry, unloving towards us, the question is, do we see ourselves primarily as in that person's hands or in God's hands? If we're in God's hands, then we don't need to deal with that person's bad attitudes or bad actions. We just give back to them what God gives to us. You know, it's interesting. Our daughter and son-in-law are trying to buy a house here. Have people in their lives that have told them, wow, you're crazy for wanting to live in, you know, Southern California. The housing prices are exorbitant. You know, it's so expensive there. They've also been told, well, the housing market is, you know, maybe at a peak, it's going to slump. You know, you don't want to buy a house now. But hey, they want to be near Lori and me, right? You know, whatever. They want to come back here probably because we have days like today. They're trying to buy a house, but it was interesting when we were talking with them about it. They asked us about, you know, well, what do you guys, you know, you think about buying houses here? And we said, well, what we can tell you is we bought a house in 1990, and we said at the time, you know, we had lived here for 11 years and rented, thought we'd never going to be able to buy a house. And then we said, because the housing market just kept going up and up and up and up. We said the only thing that could damage the housing market in Southern California is if we buy a house. Well, we bought a house, and guess what happened? You know, down it went, you know. But you know what? We didn't worry about it because we knew something. We had confidence in real estate in San Diego, coastal San Diego County. We knew, you know, if you don't just get caught up in the day-to-day, you just say, we're here for the long haul. We don't worry about it. We put our confidence in the housing market in California. Guess what happens? We don't sweat. We don't worry. And sure enough, today, even though our house fell in value after we bought it pretty precipitously, today it's worth three times what it was back in 1990. And we told them, you just put your confidence in that thing, real estate in Southern California, and you don't have to worry about all of the fluctuations that happen in between. You see the analogy there? If we put our confidence in God, then we don't have to worry about all the fluctuations and the stuff that's happening in life. We just say, it's in God's hands. So I'm going to trust him to make it all come out the way he thinks is best. Let me tell you what happened in Lou Holtz's story. In his discussion with his wife as he was preparing his invective to fire back, she said, I don't think that's a very good idea. I think what you need to do tomorrow is be gracious and calm and say good things about the athletic director, wish University of Arkansas good, and move on. You gotta be kidding me! But she won him over, and that's what he did. He got another job as a football coach at the University of Minnesota, coached there 2 years, and then was surprised. He had made in his contract with the University of Minnesota one out clause, and that was if Notre Dame ever offered him a job that he could get out of his contract at Minnesota, because his dream job was to coach at Notre Dame. And after 2 years at Minnesota, he was contacted by Notre Dame and asked to interview for their opening as head coach. He interviewed, he got the job, but was interested. Why did they choose him? And so he asked, what made you decide to pursue me as your coach? And the athletic director at Notre Dame said, well, I talked to a number of people asking for their who they would recommend. And he said, I really respect Frank Broyles, who's the AD at Arkansas. And I asked him who he would recommend. And he recommended you and said firing you was the worst mistake he'd ever made. And he realized, had he followed up on his desire to shoot back, he never would have gotten his dream job. But because he followed his wife's advice and gave back kindness for evil, he got his dream. So there you go. 20th century. French filmmaker Robert Bresson said, make visible what without you might never have been seen. What we want to make visible is the grace and love of our Lord Jesus Christ. We do it by this new covenant relating of returning good for evil. Let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for David's example, and we've seen so many where he didn't come through, but in this one he clearly did in an amazing way, in a situation where every human instinct would be to go with Abishai and say, cut that guy's head off. And David just trusted in you. David gave grace. Help us, Lord, because we're all going to feel that anger, that desire to mirror back to people whatever they give to us. But help us remember what our lives are really about, and they're really about loving people and glorifying you. And the way you've told us that we can do that is by giving back to people good and grace and kindness and patience and love, whether they deserve it or not. So help us, Lord, to model that the way David did that day. When those mutts show up, Lord, help us to love them. We pray this in the name of our Lord Jesus. Amen.